introduction. Wow.
Hi, guys. Can I pull this down just a little? Is it going to mess up? I mean, I'm wearing 5-inch heels, and I still don't reach the top of the microphone. Okay. First, I want to thank the committee for this really sweet, loving invitation to be of service. I've had the privilege of speaking in this area several times between Hilton Head and Savannah, and, you know, every time I come back, it's different, and probably because I'm different. But it's really beautiful. You know, I've noticed what you guys are doing with this town is unbelievable. Really, I see so much of the what used to be like old buildings are now like fabulous spaces. And wow, you're trying to get everybody here, aren't you? Wow, it's really beautiful. But I want to thank my host, Rob, and just say to him, you are very, very lucky that I only asked you to go to Walgreens last night and not Walmart. Because I love Walmart. I discovered Walmart in the South, actually, because in California I had never seen a Walmart until they brought them to my area. And I was in Walgreens about 15, 20 minutes. Had it been a Walmart, I'm telling you, he would have been huffing and puffing, looking at his watch, because I would have been there easily an hour. Easily. So thank you, and thanks for being so patient. When I came in today, I had several people stop me that have heard me speak over the years, and some people had mentioned that they hadn't seen me for a while. And, you know, I just want to say that, you know, for some of us, we get to a place in our recovery where we know it's our job to just step back for a bit. Because sometimes, you know, the ego becomes really, really powerful. And I have to tell you, I just started to feel that way a few years ago. I would be stopped in the airport. People would tell me, oh, my God, Francine, you saved my life. And, you know, when you hear that enough, even if you don't want to, it's easy to buy into the press. And so I just prayed to step back. And God gave me the grace and the ability to just do other service, be involved in this program as I have continued for many, many years. And anyway, I'm grateful that I'm here today. You know, I really am. I'm already crying. So let me just tell you, if you're somebody sitting in the audience who has a problem with senior citizens who can't control their emotions, you might want to leave right about now. Because I absolutely make no apologies about it. And you know what? If you've heard me speak before, time to time, you know, the authenticity comes through and I just start leaking. So anyway, just want to forewarn you. You might want to be close to the door if that's a problem. My sobriety date is July 26, 1979. And so you're not having a problem figuring it out, I'm 40 years sober. I'm 66 years old. And senior citizen, and I'm going into my 30th Medicare. Yes, yes. And, you know, I'm with my husband 23 years, and I don't know which of those numbers blows me away more. Because if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, none of those numbers would even be happening. I wouldn't be 66 coming up on 67. I wouldn't be with my husband this many years, and I definitely wouldn't be 40 years sober. But, you know, today I am. And it's for the grace of God that I get to stand before you this afternoon, truly clean and sober. I have not had a drink or a drug in my body. And honestly, that for me is just, it's a gift. It's a gift. So I'm so glad to be here. I'm grateful to be standing upward. And I'm grateful to know where I was last night and who I slept with. You know, and it wasn't him, so don't even. I was on the phone with my husband. And, you know, I'm grateful to know that when I go back home to California, I will go with every article of clothing I left with. So there. And we moved. I'm not in Mill Valley anymore, the San Francisco Bay Area. My husband and I now live in the desert. If anybody has ever been down to the Palm Desert, Palm Springs area, that's where we live, where it's nice and warm. But I've been many places. I've lived in many places. But I'm a Georgia girl.
I was born right here. Born right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Yeah. Atlanta, Georgia, with all those purdy dogwood trees. How I remember them. You know, I was telling Rob yesterday when I was walking, my sister and I used to catch fireflies, lightning bugs, we used to call them, in the jar. And at night, we'd just light them up, and then we'd let them go, you know. Wow. It's good I even remember that stuff. Because sometimes at this stage of the game, I don't remember a lot. But I do remember where I've come from. I do remember. So a few months ago, I was in New York. Anybody ever been in New York? A handful of people. Well, if you're old enough to have been to New York like 30, 40, 50 years ago, and if you've been back in the last few years, you've probably seen some changes that have taken place. I was on the plane with a young woman the other day, and I guess she was in her late 20s, maybe early 30s, and she sounded like she was from New York. So I said to her, "Oh, are you from New York?" And she looked at me and said, "No, I'm from Brooklyn." And I thought, oh, my God, how things have changed. There was a time nobody would admit to going to Brooklyn or being from there, let alone. And today, Brooklyn is its own very special zip code. But, you know, a lot of parts of New York have changed. Harlem's changed. The Bowery's changed. Times Square has changed. And, you know, I remember a number of years ago, you'd walk through Times Square, and it was like super, super, super seedy. And now they've got these fancy hotels and these very chic galleries and restaurants. And so I was there a few months ago, and I'm in New York pretty frequently, either for work or to see my mom. But I was there for work this trip, and I was staying at a hotel on Broadway between 45th and 46th. And I had gone, it was a Friday night, I had gone to dinner with some colleagues, and I was walking back to the hotel. And I noticed on the corner ahead, there was a woman. I couldn't tell it first that she was young or not, but I did notice she was standing on the corner doing a pose, apparently selling every single thing she had of value. She was wearing a red dress that was so tight, it looked like somebody took a red paintbrush and just painted red onto her skin. And the dress was so short, in fact, it looked more like a blouse than a dress. And she was facing me at first, and then she turned around, and I noticed that the dress really was short because it came right above the crease of her behind. And, you know, as I noticed some of the women who I was with, they were kind of snickering and sneering and pointing at her. And, you know, as I got closer to her, first they gave her a look, you know, the kind of look that some of us give to people when we think their station in life is beneath ours. And I know there are some of you who have probably been there, thinking that you're a little bit better than the next person. I know, as much as I hate to admit it, there have been times in my life when I've been there. Not lately. That's not who I am today. But I have been there in my life where I've given somebody a look just thinking they were just a step below me. But I've also been the recipient of a look like that. So I know how that feels. Anyway, as I got to the corner and the woman had turned around and I was actually about to cross over, I just looked at her and I just said hello for no particular reason other than she was literally standing next to me. And sometimes I have a tendency to say hi to people. You taught me that. But I said hello also because I thought I knew her. No, I really didn't know her. But in fact, I knew who she was. Because you see, 40 years ago, that was me, standing on that exact same street corner, selling everything I thought I had of value. I'd become one more statistic, one more casualty in a life that was so pathetically poorly lived. And yet that's where I found myself at 18 years old. I mean, I was a kid, but I was on the streets because that's where my drugs and alcohol took me. You know, sometimes people say to me, they'll say, "Oh, my God, Francine, I can't believe you say that from the podium, that you're so courageous." And, you know, I wasn't always willing to tell you where I've come from. In fact, in my early years, I'd skirt around the issue. And I loved when you told us newcomers that we should share in a general way what it used to be like.
I love that, because I shared so generally half the time you didn't even know I had a problem. But, you know, as the years have gone by, as I've gotten healthier, as my life, my insights have changed, I've become less and less fearful of what you may think. But I also have the courage to tell the truth today about where I've come from, because, you see, I believe in this room, maybe most of you have never felt any shame, but I believe there are a handful of you in here who know what I'm talking about. Your story might not even be the same as mine, but there are a handful of you in here who know what it's like to come into Alcoholics Anonymous with your tail between your legs because of who you had become when you were drinking and using. You see, I know that there are people in this room who know what that shame looks like, what it feels like. Maybe you did something as a mom that, God, you vowed you'd never do. Maybe you sold your kids. Maybe you neglected your kids. Maybe you allowed a man to take control and your kids became less important. Maybe you're a guy and you did some pretty horrible things to children, to whoever. But I believe there are many of us in here who come to the table when we get sober with that shame that just, it washes over us. And so for me, every time I have the courage to tell the truth about where I've come from, I believe I give you, and you permission to do the same. Because you see, I also know with all the years I'm sober that Alcoholics Anonymous, when I became willing to do the work, allowed me to step out of the darkness into the light. That's what you gave me. And that's what I believe when we can get past that shame. And I'll tell you, I've known people who've gone out because they couldn't get past the shame. They couldn't. But if you become willing a day at a time, if you're somebody sitting in here right now, whether you're new or you've got years under your belt, if you're sitting here and you've got stuff inside that's just gnawing at you, that's eating at you, I can just say that, you know, I've come from that place and my willingness to do what you've suggested has set me free, and how grateful I am. But the other reason I'm willing to talk about my past is, honestly, that's not who I am anymore. I don't live that way anymore. I'm not selling my body today for anybody, for any price. That's what you've taught me. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm so, so grateful to be sober, because I tell you, when I look back over the years, it's hard for me to believe that I am the person I am. Sometimes I look at myself in the mirror and I gotta pinch me because I can't believe this is real. I mean, I can't believe it. And yet it is. But you know what? Let me step back, because it started way before that. You know, those feelings of differentness that got me to a point where I sought solace through drugs, alcohol, and men. I was born in Atlanta in 1953 at a hospital that's not even there anymore. Tells you how old that I am. But I was born in Atlanta, and, you know, as far back as I can remember, and I don't remember all the details. I'm always amazed when people are able to tell you exactly what they did and what they had for breakfast when they were five. Honestly, I can't tell you what I had for breakfast yesterday, but definitely not back then. But what I do remember about those early days is I remember that I hurt. I remember more than anything else, my soul ached. I was always in so much pain as a kid. You know, I remember as a kid I used to use razor blades to scrape off my skin, and I'd use bleaching cream to take off my color because I just couldn't stomach living in this body. I mean, I was a kid. And I knew I hated myself that much. Before we moved from Mill Valley, I was driving into San Francisco. And if anybody knows that area, it was where the Buckeye is located. And I was driving onto the 101, and there was a hitchhiker standing there with a huge sign that said, "Anywhere but here." And I got it. I may not have gotten it in the way he was thinking it, but I got it, because all my life I just wanted to be anywhere but here. I didn't want to be in this skin. I used to try to unzip my skin and step out because I just couldn't stomach living here, living in this. You know, I was always the kid that wanted to, or felt like. I was like a round peg in a square hole. And that's a pretty painful place to live when you're a child, at any age, but definitely when you're a child. I hated everything about me. I hated being a girl. I remember when I was 11 years old, I started to develop, and I wasn't much bigger than I am now, and I'm small. But when I was a kid, I mean, having breasts, even little ones, was so embarrassing because I wanted to be like the other girls, and so I would wear these big shirts to cover myself. And I hated being a Southerner. I hated being born in the South. I was born in the 50s, and I was raised in the 60s. And, you know, I hated everything about me. Kids would make fun of me. When I moved to New York in 1959 with my strong Southern accent, the kids made fun of me. They laughed at me. They called me down in the cornfield. And, you know, at that stage in my life, I didn't have any program for living that allowed me or helped me to deal with that. So I hated that. And, you know, I remember I'd stand in front of the mirror when I was a little kid, and I'd read, practicing getting rid of my Southern accent, because that's how much I hated myself. It wasn't about the South. It was about me just hating who I was. I hated being poor. And it always amazes me when I hear speakers who get up on the platform and talk about how they grew up poor, but they didn't really know it. Well, that was not my experience. I grew up poor, and I knew it every single day of my life. I had a very intimate relationship with powdered eggs and powdered milk, and I knew what welfare lines looked like. And I hated being poor. I hated it. My grandmother was a seamstress at Rich's in Atlanta, and I remember whenever her, and she had some wealthy clients on the side, and whenever her clients, when their kids didn't want to wear an outfit the second time, they'd give it to us, me and my sister. And it was like, always we had the hand-me-downs. But you know, more than anything else, what I really hated about myself the most was I hated being black. I hated being a black kid. Again, I was born in the South, and I was born in the South during the days when lynchings were legal. And I remember going into, my mom was taking us to Rich's one day to visit my grandmother, and I didn't understand that there were colored bathrooms and white bathrooms and that I wasn't allowed in one or the other. And I remember walking into a bathroom that apparently said white, and this woman yanked me, and she scolded my mom, and my mom just stood there because what else could she do? So I got the impression really early on that it was horrible to be living in this skin, horrible to be living in this body. There was a television movie that came out, I think it was like the late 80s or the very early 90s. It was called Separate But Equal. And it was about the former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's effort to create change in this country. And I remember in this television movie, they were trying to understand, there was a scene they had, and they were trying to understand the impact of segregation on small kids. They were trying to understand the impact on a child's self-esteem, of segregation on a child's self-esteem. And so in this segment, they brought all these little kids together in a control group setting. There were little white boys, little white girls, black girls. And they just asked them a battery of questions. There weren't any trick questions. They just asked them some questions that most folks would consider kind of simple. But I remember they came to this little black girl who, by almost anybody's standard of cuteness, almost, would have considered her cute. She had long pigtails and big bubble bangs like some of us used to wear, and she had these little freckles on her face. She was adorable, and honestly, I don't think she was over 12, maybe 10, maybe 11. I don't remember. She was very young. And in responding to a question, they asked her, they put four dolls in front of her. There was a little boy, a little black boy doll, a little white boy doll, a little black girl doll, and a little white girl doll. And they simply asked this girl to pick out the ugliest doll of the four. That was all. Again, not a trick question. Just pick out the ugliest doll in front of you. And I can tell you without blinking her eye, without hesitating for a moment, she didn't pick the doll that looked like you. She didn't pick the doll that looked like you. She didn't pick the doll that looked like you. Instead, she grabbed a hold of the doll that looked exactly like herself because for her, that was the ugliest person she knew. I was 10 years, 11 years sober when I saw that movie, and I'm going to tell you, it took me back to that painful place where I lived when I grew up. That's the place I started with. So if there was anybody paying attention to me as a small child, if there was anybody who was sensitive to the pain of children, they probably knew as they looked at me, this pathetic little soul, that eventually I was going to find a way out of that gnawing pain. Eventually I was. And eventually I did. Long before I ever picked up drugs or alcohol, my earliest escape in life came through books and movies. And I loved books. I loved books and I loved old movies, or at least they're old now. Not when I was growing up. But I loved books. My mom was a librarian, and in our house, there were books everywhere. In every room, along every wall, there were reams and reams and reams of books. It was so cool. Sometimes I would take a book off the shelf and I'd go sit in a corner all by myself. And I think my mom probably thought I was trying to become a smart kid. But what was really happening is when I opened up a book, between those binders was magic. When I opened up a book, all of a sudden I was like Cinderella going to the ball. It was amazing because just for a slice in time, I was different. I was not me. And that was just fine. But you know, as with many of us who are alcoholics in this room and drug addicts, you know, there comes a time when using something outside of ourselves just doesn't work. And instead of the books and movies, it was at the age of 14 when I picked up my first chemical. And I didn't put my chemicals down until I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 26. I'd like to tell you that I am somebody who actually had fun drinking. Because I know there are lots of alcoholics I hear who talk about how they love the taste, they had a great time. Honestly, that is not me. I never liked the taste of alcohol. And I say that because there may be someone in here who's relatively new and they're thinking, oh my God, if I didn't like the taste, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. I never liked the taste of alcohol. But it didn't matter because I drank it for the effect. I drank it because when I picked up that drink, it was just like with the books. I was like Cinderella going to the ball. But you know what happens, at least for some of us? I didn't plan on alcohol taking hold of my life like I did. I really didn't. I thought I was in control. But one day added to another day, which added to another day. And before I knew it, I was consumed by drugs and alcohol. By drugs and alcohol. At 18 years old, I was living on the streets homeless because of my addiction. At 18 years old, I was a kid. 18. I couldn't stop drinking and I couldn't stop using. And I would really like to tell you that that being a prostitute was the worst thing that I ever allowed to happen to me or ever did in my life. But the truth is, and I'm going to say this because I happen to believe there are some people in this room, mostly women, perhaps some men, who have experienced this, and I just need you to know you're not alone. You can get through it. The worst thing probably for me is when I allowed people to put their hands on me and treat me in a way that I should never allow anybody to put their hands on me. I became a punching bag for the men in my life because that's all I thought I deserved. And I would let them convince me that it was my fault. Had I not done this, they wouldn't have beat the hell out of me. Had I not done that, they wouldn't have stabbed me with those scissors. If I had not done that, I wouldn't be in the position I was in. And so today I can tell you, not only do I not drink or use, not only do I not compromise myself as a woman, but today I don't allow any man or woman to put their hands on me. And that is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at that stage of my life, I didn't know any better. I didn't. I was first introduced to AA in 1978 in New York. And, you know, it, in 1978, I was 25 years old, and I just thought I had this thing together. I thought I did. You know, I never thought I could be an alcoholic, because I remember as a kid, you know, again, I loved books and movies and TV, and I remember I loved women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward, and I know some of you are old enough to remember those people. Sometimes I'm speaking at a meeting with all people under 40, and they're looking at me like, what? What is she talking about? Who is that? That doesn't look like Beyonce or whatever. But I remember those women, and I love them. I love them. These are women that had a glass in one hand. They'd have a cigarette in the other hand. And they didn't take a lot of garbage off anybody. And for me, I was a kid who needed that to fill this hole. I needed it. Anyway, I love them. I love them. And I learned a lot about being a female from watching them. Holding my glass with my pinky stuck out, which I still have a tendency to do. Smoking those cigarettes. I remember I used to love Betty Davis, especially in the movie All About Eve, where she's having this party and she's walking up the staircase with her long, sexy cigarette holder talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. Had she only known how bumpy my ride was to become. But that's where it took me. I was introduced in 1978 to Alcoholics Anonymous, and even with all of the life history that I had already had, I still didn't believe that I had a problem. And so I continued to drink and use. I got hit by a car in 1970. Oh my God. I got sober in 1979. I got hit by a car in June of 1979. I had done what I learned was a geographic. And if you're new and you're kind of figuring out what a geographic is, it simply means you physically move from point A to point B thinking you're going to leave all that baggage behind you. Well, surprise, like me, I moved from point A to point B. I moved from New York to Las Vegas, Nevada, thinking I was going to be cured of whatever my ailment was. But instead, I really found, I found the end and I found the beginning. I was hit by a car in a blackout in Vegas, and the last thing I remember was I was in a discotheque. We used to have discotheques back in the day, and it was appropriately named The Brewery. And the next thing I remember was I came to with my body in traction, and my left leg was in a cast all the way up my thigh. And I remember... I knew nothing. I had not a clue how I had gotten there. What I was told by the police was that I had been hit by a car in a blackout. And the doctors, they told me they thought I'd never walk again. Because when they found me, my left leg was up behind my head and the bone had come straight through. And I actually am about an inch shorter on my left side, which is why it's hard for me to even stand still, because take the pressure off my back. But they never thought I'd ever walk again. You know, and I walk with a 10-inch scar on my leg, and I've often had people say, Francine, have you ever considered having cosmetic surgery? Because the scar is so ugly. I mean, I have a 10-inch scar with a lot of hole marks that came straight through the leg. And, you know, I can just say for today, for me, I choose not to cover it up. Maybe when I'm 41 years sober, I'll clean it up. Who knows? I don't know. But every time I look at my broken leg and this scar, I am reminded of every price I ever paid to stand before you. I'm reminded of every drink I've ever taken, of every drug I've ever put in my body, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I have ever performed. And so just for today, when I look at this leg, it's like I say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. And, you know, now, as you see, I'm wearing heels. I can still walk. But for a long time, they never thought I did. But you know what? If you're a real deal alcoholic sitting in this room, you know that no mere car accident is going to make you stop drinking and using, because if you are on a mission, that's what matters. and I was clearly on a mission to kill myself without even knowing I was. I continued to drink and use for about a month and a half, and then July 26, 1979, I put down the drugs and alcohol for what I pray to God was the last time. I prayed to God, but you know what? It's not promised to any of us. I sit in meetings every single day, and I've heard women with, and mostly I go to women's meetings, I've heard women with many, many, many years of recovery who have gone out. So I know it's not promised to me. I know if I get too far off the beam, it could happen to me too. And so I stay in the middle of AA. So I came in Vegas, and people say to me, oh my God, how could you get sober in Vegas? And all I can say is when your number is up, wherever you are lucky enough to be, God bless you. And so I was lucky enough to be in Las Vegas, probably in the most decadent part of the world at the time, and I needed something like that. And there were so many There were 40 meetings when I got sober in Vegas. Now they've got, what, over 400 or so. But when I got sober, there were 40 meetings. And, boy, I tell you, I used to sit in the back of the room in what I endearingly like to call the inventory section. And I'd sit in the back. I'd cross my arms. I'd take up three seats. Now, nobody needs three seats in an AA meeting. I don't care who you are. But me, because of my bad attitude, I'd be sitting in the back. I'd have a seat for my behind. I'd have one for my broken leg. Okay, I got that. But then I had a chair for my crutches. Talk about wanting to keep a barrier between me and you. I came into the meetings and I hated everybody. I hated men and I hated women, and that doesn't leave a whole lot of people in between. I mean, I didn't like anybody. I came in and I sat and I just took your inventory. And then I was about 30 days sober and someone suggested to me I needed to get a sponsor. And I will tell you that the woman who was to become my sponsor clearly was the single most important person ever in my life. Ever. And I hated her with a passion. I hated Louise so much. Honestly, she was just horrible. My opinion is she just forgot what it was like to be young and cute and new. She just really, I think she just was jealous. She was 59 years old, so she was really old. And I mean, she was 19 years sober when I met her. She just forgot. And she wasn't all that cute. So I think she was just really jealous of me. I never told her, of course, but I believe that. Because she just didn't want me to have any fun. I mean, all she ever talked about was gratitude, meetings, God, the steps, books. It's like, oh my golly, gee, I'm 26 years old. You know, give me a break. Let me have some fun. Well, her idea of fun was going to an AA meeting and maybe going to an AA party. That was fun. And so, you know, I hated this woman. But I will tell you, the reason I hated her, honestly, was not because she was a horrible human being. I hated Louise because she was the only person in my life who ever had the courage to tell me the truth. That is the truth. She had no holes barred. She didn't care that I didn't like her, and it's a good thing because I didn't. But she just would call it like she saw it. And I thought, my gosh, she's so insensitive. You know, people talk about AA people being loving and kind, and she just was none of those things. But lucky me, because, you know, she loved me more than I loved myself. She saw something in me that I was not capable of seeing in myself at the time. And she's now gone to that big AA meeting in the sky. And, you know, I'm so grateful for the years I had with her. She taught me a lot of things. I'd like to share with you a few of them because they were so significant. They are things that literally have helped me become the woman that I am today. A woman that, in fact, can look at herself in the mirror and like the person who looks back. And let me just say, these are things that work for me. They don't have to work for you. First thing is I had that nasty little habit of sleeping with other people's husbands. Oh, my God. You know, I thought she should have been a little bit more understanding there, but she wasn't. So I remember one day, I said to her, Louise, what am I supposed to do? I mean, if I'm walking down the street and a guy is holding on to his honey and he's giving me the eye, I said, what should I do? And she said the stupidest thing, and I still think it's stupid. She said, you turn your head. I'm thinking, what? Why should I be so inconvenienced? That doesn't even make sense. I'm the one that had to take the high road. But you know, high road or not, like it or not, I'm one of those women that paid attention. And it took me a while. I was still acting out my first 2 years of sobriety. But eventually her words sunk in. She used to talk about self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, it's not about how you think or how you feel, it's how you behave. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And she was right, because as my behavior changed, my feelings about myself changed. You know what I want to do? I want to read something. This is in conference-approved literature, just in case there are any AA purists in the room. And thank you to the gentleman. I was only going to borrow this book, and someone was so sweet to buy it for me. So if there's a newcomer who wants an S. Bill Caesar and you don't have one, this one's yours. So this is what Louise said to me, because I remember in the beginning I would hear all these people saying, some of them were old-timers, well, 6 years, 5 years. They would say, this program is not about anything other than not drinking. That's all it's about, just about not drinking. And Louise said, no, 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 no. She said, read what Bill W. had to say, not what some person in an AA meeting told you. So this is what Bill W. had to say in As Bill Sees It, which is my favorite AA book. And it's on the very first page. So that tells you how important Bill W. thought this was. It says, it has often been said of AA that we are interested only in alcoholism. That is not true. We have to get over drinking in order to stay alive. But anyone who knows the alcoholic personality by firsthand contact knows that no true alky ever, ever stops drinking permanently without undergoing a profound personality change. Not a little change, not a change if you feel like it, but a profound personality change. And Louise believed that the way to sustained recovery, one that I could enjoy, was that I had to change my behavior. The woman who crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous, she said, if you are still that woman, if you're lucky enough to stay sober with some years, if you are still behaving the same way you behaved when you crawled in here, if you're not drinking or using drugs, you will wish you were. So the first thing was she had me change my behavior about sleeping with other people's husbands. And I'll tell you, there is not one woman in this room or any room who would ever have to worry about me being in the same space with her man. Now, that might not mean a lot to some of you in here, but to me, it means a lot, because that tells me how far I've come, where I would think nothing of being in an AA meeting with my little hot pants and my little scarf. And you know, I would, at the time, I used to let guys kiss me on the lips. I would be touching their arms and their shoulders. It's like so inappropriate. That wouldn't happen today because of what Louise taught me. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. The next thing she taught me that was really quite important for me was to change the way I dressed. So I used to come into meetings. Now, that woman who I saw on the corner of 46 and 8th, she was wearing a dress really, really tight and really, really short. Well, I was wearing hot pants that were probably equally as short and equally as tight. Way after hot pants were in, I was still wearing them. And my hot pants were like the size of a sash, about 6 inches. And while I may have been a lot smaller then, believe me, my cheeks were still hanging out, not my facial cheeks. And I was wearing these little pieces of scarf, just enough to cover my nipples. But the rest of everything was hanging out. And I'd go into meetings. I still wear high heels. But I used to wear high heels with big taps. So I would go into a meeting late, number one. And instead of being quiet, going to the back, sitting down, you know, quietly, I would walk to the front of the TIE club in Vegas with my little hot pants and my scarf and my taps, and I'd walk across the front of the room where the speaker was speaking just so people could pay attention to me. I mean, I was like Miss Priss, and I thought I was the pussycat's meow, for sure. Louise, one day, she saw this, and she just said, you know what, again, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. If you act like a hooker, if you dress like a hooker, if every other word out of your mouth is like a hooker, then you can't expect people to treat you any differently. So today I dress appropriately for the occasion. I don't wear I don't wear bikinis anymore. But even if I was, I wouldn't be wearing them in an AA meeting. I'd be wearing them at the pool. But the last thing that Louise taught me in terms of behavior, and again, this is just me, it's my experience, not anyone else's, I came in with a mouth that was quite filthy. Every other word out of my mouth was a four-letter word, and you would have thought I didn't know any other language. And maybe I didn't. Who knows? I wasn't very bright. But I would curse simply because I could. And I remember Louise would say to me, every time you curse, I noticed that people laugh in an AA meeting. And I realized, just like when I would wear my little hot pants, I needed attention desperately because I so hated myself. So she said, every time you curse, you take the focus off of your message and you put the focus on you as a messenger. Well, I didn't really care because I had a messy message and I didn't care if you listened to me before. But today, I don't have a messy message. And I don't want you to be distracted by curse words. So for me, I choose not to curse. But believe me, it didn't happen overnight. And this is the truth. One day, this is when answering machines just came into the picture. What time are we? This is when answering machines just came into being. And I remember I had left a message for Louise, and honestly, I must have been on a rant, I guess, because I didn't like the fact that there was an answering machine. Well, she had the audacity to play the message back to me. Oh, my God. Even I was appalled. I couldn't believe what the words I was saying to my sponsor. So we went on this little process of changing my mouth, cleaning it up. We went from this, I swear this is so true, we went from 20 curse words to a sentence down to 10 curse words. Then she helped me get down to like 5 curse words to a sentence. And then it was like every other sentence had a curse word until one day I wasn't cursing. And I can tell you, for me, that is an esteemable act. But what started to happen as I stopped cursing, I needed to substitute words because I didn't have a lot of language. And I got interested in studying. And I'm not going to give this person's story away, but June is somebody who was one of my inspirations when I made a decision to go back to school. And, you know, I'm a high school dropout. I'm a hooker with a criminal record. And women like me don't get to do anything but be hookers. That's all, because that's all people expect of you, whether you're living in a penthouse, which I was, or you're off the streets, which I also was. But I was 2 years sober, and you know, because of this guidance that Louise was giving me, I realized I wanted to be a woman of substance. I didn't know what it looked like, but I knew it didn't look like me. And so as Louise kept training me to behave differently, I started to really care about how I carried myself and what was going into my brain. And there was a woman in Vegas who had started to go back to school, and she used to let me come and audit classes with her. And then I remember hearing June, and, you know, it was like I just started going back to school. I was a high school dropout. I got my GED, and then I moved back to New York to complete my education. And in 1986, I graduated from college, and I moved down to Washington, D.C. to totally complete my education. And then in 1989, I moved back to New York, having graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can tell you, a girl off the streets in New York who only used to sell her body, who used to pay lawyers to keep her out of jail, the fact that I get to stand before you today, being able to practice law anywhere, is truly a gift from God and Alcoholics Anonymous. Really.
I know. But I want to say that that didn't come easily either. You know, I'm not an overnight success. It's taken me 40 years to be 40 years sober. It's taken me 66 years on the planet to have the experience I have. And it took me 10 years to get through school to become a lawyer. And, you know, it was a struggle, but I never gave up. And, you know, I want to say this because over the years I've come across many people who've had dreams and those dreams have been squashed because sometimes we share those dreams with people who are in a position to squash those dreams. I used to go, this is the way I like to put it, I used to go to hardware stores looking for oranges. I used to go to people who were totally incapable of supporting me in a dream because they were themselves living in fear. How can you support someone out of their fear if you're stuck in your own? I went to women who were in marriages they hated, who were living a life they couldn't stand. I couldn't expect them to support me out of it, but Louise did. Louise did. She said, "Sweetheart, you can do anything you want if you are willing to do the footwork. If you are willing to do the footwork." And that's always the case in Alcoholics Anonymous. If we stay sober and we're willing to do the footwork, we get to enjoy recovery. And if we, you know, I remember Louise would say, if you do a little bit, you'll get back a little bit. If you do a lot, you'll get back a lot. And if you do nothing in this program, you will find yourself wasted. And it was no different with dreams. And, you know, I've had many people, again, that have come to me wanting to do things and they don't feel they can get the support that they need. I understand what that's like. I know what it's like. But I also know there are people in this room, there are people in your meetings where if you have a dream, as long as you don't drink or use drugs, they will support you through it. When I was new, I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of sobriety. And I'll tell you, that list would have been very short. And it was filled with material things that I had lost. Diamond rings and fur coats and kitty cats and stereos. That's what was on that list. Never would you have found any of the intangibles that I so value today. But today on that list, you'd find things like a God that I didn't believe in when I got sober. I was forced to go to Baptist Sunday school, but I never really believed in God. But I believe that it was God that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was Alcoholics Anonymous that took me to a God that's so unbelievably sweet. Not always loving, but sweet. Because you see, my God pushes me in ways that I need to be pushed. I don't always want to be pushed, but I have a God that loves me that much that it just pushes me and pushes me to be my very best. Today, I'm one of those people that the 11th step talks about. I would no more do without my faith than I would air, food, or sunshine. What you'd also find on that list today is my mom. And I know sitting in a meeting with women, that's sometimes a pretty dirty word. But I want to say that, you know, when I was new, I liked the women who hated their mothers. They talk badly about their moms, and I love them because I felt that same way. But as I started to do the work in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to pay more attention to the women who loved their mothers, who had worked through the issues they had because they knew that they were their mother's daughter. And I'm so grateful that I'm one of those women that paid attention. Today, my mom is one of my best friends, and it's not always easy. You know, my mom's a double amputee, and my mother should be in a home right now, and she refuses to go. Pain is so great, it has totally taken over his life. And, you know, I never thought that I would feel the way I feel about a man, but you taught me that. You taught me how to love people who are different than me. You taught me how to open my heart and be willing to see another side. Be willing to hear a different perspective. I get to practice that in my life a lot today. I have very close friends who share different political views, different religious views, different views. And yet we get to coexist in a loving way because of what you've taught me, for sure. So I want to say thank you. Thank you for the life that you've given me. Thank you for the opportunity
to be a woman who walks with dignity and walks with pride. Wasn't always my experience, but today it is. And so in closing, I'd like to read one more thing from AA Conference Approved Literature, because this is such a reminder that I have, I know, Conference Approved Literature, I know. Yes, it is. I like to read this too when I close, because it reminds me of how far I have come, because I know what that victim mentality looks like. It used to be, I used to have a little V written on my forehead, for sure, but now I don't. Now it's just a lot of makeup. It's on page 4, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And that's what you've taught me in 40 years of sobriety, that it doesn't matter where I've come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, it doesn't matter even whether I believe in God or not. I happen to, but I don't have to. You've taught me that the only thing that matters in this overall scheme of things is what I do with this most precious gift you've given me. Not just what I do in an AA meeting, because most of the time it's easy to be nice in AA, most of the time. But you've taught me that the real work is what I do out there. It's how do I take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and put them into practice out in the real world. When I'm driving my car, am I really ready? Somebody cuts me off. Am I ready to give them the finger or use some expletive? You know, if somebody is in the supermarket like yesterday where they've got the sign says 10 items and they've got 25, am I standing there counting what they have and huffing and puffing? Or the line in the supermarket, or the bank is not moving quickly enough? Or how do I treat my husband? Do I treat my husband like a dog and I treat my sponsees like little goddesses? The real work you've taught me is, it starts here in our little laboratory called AA, but the real work is what we do out there. And I just want you to know how grateful I am for each and every one of you who's ever touched my life in little and small ways. And for that, I am grateful. Thank you.